Welcome to the World Science Festival Brisbane podcast. My name is Jim Thompson, CEO of the Queensland Museum Network, the proud presenters of this important event. I'm pleased to be able to share this podcast recorded at our 2023 festival. Since 2016, World Science Festival Brisbane has reached more than 1 million people, in person and online, promoting a whole-of-life entanglement with STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths, delivering on our mission of creating authentic and compelling experiences and stories that inspire, enrich and empower. This curious conversation is art, AI and interaction. Curiosity Brisbane curator Jay Younger chats with AI artists Adam Donovan and Madeline Flynn to illuminate the inspiration behind their artistic practices and specifically cybernetic intimacy and pivot, their respective artworks in Curiosity Brisbane. Please enjoy this World Science Festival Brisbane discussion.
Firstly, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which our festival is presented. We pay our respects to the elders, to their elders past, present and emerging, and we extend this respect to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples here today. My name is Jay Younger and I am the curator of Curiosity Brisbane 2023. It is my pleasure to welcome you to Art, AI and Interaction, a curious conversation as part of Curiosity. For those of you that are unfamiliar, Curiosity is an annual temporary public art event that brings together art, science and technology. Curiosity is hosted by the Queensland Museum Network and is part of the World Science Festival Brisbane. This year, the artworks are on show throughout the Cultural Centre, firstly starting here with Dylan Serres straight out there in the Whale Mall, across the Cultural Centre, South Bank, the Goodwill Bridge and the Queen Street Mall. So there's a really great work that incorporates AI as well in the Queen Street Mall. So that's a must-see as well. The artworks are able to be experienced 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily through to Sunday the 2nd of April. So you've got one more week from now to catch all of those artworks. There are a few artworks in Curiosity this year that utilise AI to ask questions about the role of AI. Bots are used for menial tasks and at times are making automated decisions on a massive scale, like approving people's mortgages, for example. And we're used to this. But increasingly, AI is used in a caretaker and a companion role as well. And that opens up a whole lot of other questions about our future interactions with AI. Today we are asking, why are artists using AI in their interactive artworks? We're here in conversation with AI artists Madeline Flynn and Adam Donovan to illuminate the inspiration behind their artistic practices and specifically pivot and cybernetic intimacy. And we've got a nice little surprise there for you at the end. That's their two artworks that are presented in Curiosity Brisbane this year. So let's start getting going a little bit more. Madeline Flynn is one of two collaborators with Tim Humphrey, who have created Pivot, and that's the talking seesaws, if you've managed to see those. Has anyone seen them yet? Great. And you can come and play with those, and Madeline and Tim, on the little Stanley Street lawn. And Adam Donovan is also one of two collaborators with Katrin Hochschuh, who have created Cybernetic Intimacy, which are the robots, the 15 robots, which you can interact with on the upper Riverside Green. So Adam is with us all the way from Germany and Madeline all the way from Victoria. So it's great to have them both here. We're going to start with a few general questions and I'll just go between each artist with that general question, and then each artist will give a little overview of their practice and talk about their particular work, whether it be Pivot or cybernetic intimacy. So to start off with a fairly straightforward question, when you think about the term artificial intelligence, what do you think? And are there any inherent problems or virtues that you see in the current and future uses of AI?
Thanks, Jay. Hello, everyone. Thanks for turning up. AI. I mean, what a huge question. And in terms of, I guess, the term itself, something artificial and something intelligent, we have experienced as cultures very problematic things to do with both those phrases. And often those words have been used to exclude people. And I guess the other thing about that term too is that, you know, it was created in used for the first times in the early 50s by some white guys. You know, so we're talking about contexts, about where things come from. So I suppose those things, that's something that, I would think about bringing to that conversation, about who's included in thinking about those things. And then I guess the virtues and problems, I mean, I find it super exciting and also super frightening at the same time. You know, so it has this absolute charm. You know, I'm really drawn to something. I'm really drawn to the possibilities and the unknown things. And I feel like it's a really exciting time to be alive because of it. And alongside that, I am very nervous about how we take care of and think about what the ethical implications of what we're doing together is. So, you know, it's like there's this cognitive dissonance thing sitting there. Both those things are there. And actually just, you know, in the when we're down at the seesaws, we talk to people a lot. And I feel like this is a common thing that, a lot of us are talking about. Both those things are sitting there.
Thank you. That's so that's a hard one for you to follow on from, Adam, actually. So
I would think something similar as well. It's I mean, when we look at algorithms that are in our lives, we often have a lot of bias, and it's not very fair. It's so socially speaking, you know, it's usually made by middle-aged white men. I'll give an example. There is the Algorithmic Justice League, and this is an African-American woman out from New York, and she runs this because she was studying at MIT doing face tracking projects for creative projects, and she would have to wear a white mask for the camera tracking to detect her, because if you go back to film and TV, it was all made for white people. It was all made for, and so it doesn't really work for different ethnicities. So this inherent bias, but also, I guess, the commercialization and the reason why these technologies are invented, I love to try and subvert them somehow and use them for something that is much more creative and can ask how you can use this in a more compassionate, humanistic way. And we often get the question of what's the purpose of the robots? And it's an interesting question to get asked, because it has to do with why you're using these things, not for a commercial reason, decidedly non-commercial.
Yeah. Well, of course, as artists, you're always probably making things in an unusual, unintended, unpredictable way.
Yeah.
Without commercial intent.
I love that plan for unintended consequences.
Yes,
you know, that's
right.
Sort of what we're doing. Yeah.
Let's just delve a little bit deeper into each of the artworks, and if you can tell me a little bit about why you wanted to use AI in your artwork and how you use it in your artwork. So it's just different in both cases.
Yeah. So I think Tim and I, you know, sort of see the role of an artist as like, I feel like we're antennas. You know, we sort of we channel what's going on, and our job is to be in relation to culture and to somehow make sense of that and make an offer back. So AI is a key cultural movement for us. And so we, instead of being separate from it, I see it as our role as artists to absorb and make an offer back. I mean, I feel like we can only make questions back, and we make other spaces for people to consider. So that's what I think we're doing.
Right. And Adam?
Yeah, it's...
Did you want to use it just because it's there, or did you... did it have some sort of logic for you to integrate it into your work?
Well, I mean, AI or machine learning, we use it, has a... if you go to in the area of cybernetics and the relationship to computing or to understand machines, I think it's really important to make those connections and the empathetic connections I'm talking about in the work let's see, it's a more complex answer is looking at apparent behaviour and also closing this loop of apparent behaviour by getting the machines to try and understand what people are feeling. And that's more about really wanting to make a tight, really close connection so that people have stronger emotions to it and that we can use that and so that we can understand ourselves as well, you know, to create a greater sense of empathy, to spread that around more.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. I mean, just as you were speaking, I just couldn't help but think of the movie AI. You know, just...
I watched it recently.
Yeah, it's actually really quite brilliant. But anyway, that's a different discussion. So to me, one thing that's interesting about both of your works, because they're interactive public artworks, they're aimed at all ages, from small children through to mature adults. So, I mean... Just now, I know that this is quite, most likely quite intentional, but why is that important to you?
Yeah, it's absolutely intentional. And actually, as I hear you talk more to Adam, I feel as if we have a lot of shared values mm-hmm. around this. Yeah. So I think we together make the world that we want to inhabit. And so if who we invite in and who is there is who is the world makers. And so we wanted to, if we think about inclusive practice, then why should generations not be part of that? So we wanted to make, we in all our projects, try and make spaces where everybody can be together. And that is hard. It's difficult to make something that makes sense for a two-year-old that also makes sense for somebody who's 80. And in public space, everybody's there. Mm. It's free. Everybody's invited. Who's going to come? We don't know. So we need to make a situation that's going to respond to that. So it is really important to us. I feel like it's important for the future of art. I feel like, you know, new experimental practice comes through putting difficult things in public space and see what happens. That's...
Do you feel like there's a bunch of levels floating around in the artwork at the same time that it is like film in that sense where, you know, half the audience, the kids are laughing at that part and the adults are laughing at... So it's constructed to appeal to... At different points to different
absolutely,
ages.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's this nice thing about the longer you stay with something, the more gets revealed. That's also part of the offer, I think, that we can make in space. And that's also difficult in art, but I like that edge, like that challenge.
I mean, and I know that Adam is fairly recently a father again, but he's got two...
Small boys, two and 5 months.
Yes, so they're quite little. And there's been some great photos of Elliot at least interacting. So, yeah, so what are your thoughts about all the different ages? And I mean, I've seen all the different ages. A lot of children are going crazy about the robots.
Yeah, for them, I feel like it's preventative medicine for a dystopian future. Yeah. So... Because they get this experience with technology where it's about compassion and they're creatures. They often say, "I want to take it home," and they can I give it a name, and it's that apparent behaviour they're totally caught up with. And it was one example of in Poland we did a work with another work with a lot of swarm robots. And there was a young boy, his name was Viet, and he came back on multiple days to see the work. And his mother had to tell me, but he was dreaming of the robots, And he said he had to come back because he felt responsible for them. And I just wonder what these kids will grow up to do, you know, and how that will affect how what the world of tech, if they decide to work with technology somehow, what kind of positive influence that will have, which is different what the adults get. They kind of, this current work they're getting, the kids get it first because all of the cameras are usually looking lower and they're smaller. So, and it's looking at bodies. So, but then the adults don't really get it until the kids move away and it tracks them as well. And then they're, it's a little bit darker for them, I think, this the feeling of technology.
Response, different generation.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like kids as first responders. Mm. You know, kids as the leaders into something.
Yeah.
I think that's another reason for thinking about making these spaces intergenerational. Yeah.
Yeah. And they lead in, they lead the adults into
that.
And, I mean, you know, when you think about your, you know, cybernetic intimacy, in some ways it's like a robot petting zoo. You know, it's got that sort of, they're very, very, children are so drawn to them, you know, really. And as you say, they want to take them home. So, all right, so let's move on to a little bit more about Madeline and her artwork. So I know you and Tim are trained musicians and sound composers and studied experimental music, so that's kind of an interesting background. So how did you first start being interested in the field of art and technology?
The beautiful thing about music and sound is it's a big, expansive field. So right from the beginning, you're working with an instrument, which is an object. You know, you have a physical relationship with an instrument and it has sound. And then moving from instruments, then part of our training was in electroacoustic music, which is like electronic music production, different ways of thinking about that. And so then immediately I have this relationship with a generative, expansive, expressive technical space. So that becomes part of the tools, I guess, of my techniques of training that I have. So it's not a very big step from there. You know, I was thinking about when you were saying about generative learning and generative spaces, that's part of that's been in music tech for a long time. That and so some of the sort of embedded knowledges about that, musicians have that more deeply in their practice, I think, because of those long form things that have been going on there.
That sort of process driven approach.
Yes, and solving, you know, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, that doesn't work. I have to solve. There's always, you find your ways through. I think that's part of that creative tech process built into music and sound composition.
And how long ago was it that you first started really, you know, combining art and technology, not so much music, but art and technology?
How long ago? I don't know. I mean, it's funny, I grew up on a farm in northern Victoria, a big wheat farm, and two things, I reckon, that happened to me then have really stayed with me, which is about trying to understand where you are through listening. You know absolutely where you are on the farm through the sound of who's going past, who's doing what, the Doppler effect on the car, all the stuff that goes on. So you sort of locate yourself in space through listening. And then maybe actually because it was a big wheat farm, there was a lot of big gear and different seasons had different equipment and I was obsessed with that equipment. So I think maybe that combination of things has sort of stayed with me. I think the early 90s, which is when I studied music at La Trobe Uni, that was an experimental music place in Australia and had really great access to tech and really great access to people who were thinking about that. So that definitely had a big impact on me as well. Yeah.
Interesting. So you describe yourselves as audio conceptual artists. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, well, we just like made that up, right? Because it's sort of okay. How to describe what we're doing when you're in a field that's developing? And I'd like to hear what you say about this too, Adam. It's like, how do we begin to talk about the ways that we're making the principles of, because we still use orchestration, texture, timbre, rhythm in our thinking. You know, Tim and I think that we made an instrument down there with those seesaws in a way, even though maybe for other people that's not how it's received. So those principles are sitting in there. Yeah.
Okay, so listening and dialogue come up in relation to your artwork. So why is this so fundamental in your work? I mean, we've heard about the equipment and the sounds, but I know conceptually that's quite important for you and Tim too.
Yeah. I mean, I think dialogue, listening is first, and dialogue is an implication of listening. And I think maybe, like I mentioned about that sort of embedded thing of being a country kid and that space that it's created in me about knowing myself through sound. And actually Tim's a country kid too. So I think that's created spaces for us. I think being a parent, we've got three kids. I think the continually being asked questions and trying to understand the world in relation with young people and other people has kept that alive for us. Many things to say about that, but
mindful of time.
Yeah.
So your work exists almost exclusively in the public realm. And why is this public interaction and participation so important to your and Tim's work?
Yeah, I think we started to touch on that a little bit earlier, just about these who's there really matters. And so if we're in a free space, then everybody can be there. And I do really believe that thing that the future of art is only developed in collaboration with others. I don't think it's I think art is a team sport. And so the more that we can robustly be together in the development of ideas, then the better it's going to be for all of us. So, I mean, public space is, you know, there's so many, I suppose it's civic space, it's here, it's an online space. Public space has big expanded places where we can exist in communities. Like, I sort of think of them as these temporary communities that coalesce around an action or an intention or a festival. I love that about festivals. I love it that there's this temporary community of interest that comes together that, you know, has this generative feeling. I like that
and
energy.
And it's this kind of welcoming of the unfamiliar.
Yes.
So, I mean, that whilst the space of South Bank is not new to the people that go there, it can be.
Yeah.
I mean, there were Canadians on the tour yesterday that just randomly came along or whatever, just visiting.
Yeah.
But what's in South Bank changes.
Yes.
And so, what's great about the audience is that they then welcome that novel, unusual experience that they're having, and with great gusto.
Yeah, totally. It's actually a really beautiful place to be down there. There's a big diverse crowd. There's a whole lot of people coming, people who live here, but people who are visiting, people who are trying to understand where they are as well. And I think that's something that we can do in art as well. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get on to having a look at some pictures of some works by you. So if you grab that,
grab all my things.
Grab your little clicker.
Okay. I've got some notes. I'm going to read a little bit. I've got some things to show. I get a little bit nervous in these situations, so it's not my natural habitat. So thank you for your patience with that. First, I just wanted to say that Tim is down at the seesaws now, and everything that I'm talking about maybe this goes back to the answer of the question about dialogue. We've been working together for 25 years, so we have this, like, it's back and forth between us all the time. And I imagine that's like that for you and Katrina in your practice too. It's like, and that it feels like a super privileged place to be in as well. I feel very grateful for that. Okay, here we go. This. So for the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about some of our projects and concerns as artists, and then I'm going to spend about 10 minutes talking about Pivot, which is our project here with Curiosity. So first of all, this quote from Rebecca Soldnick, which is from her book, The Field Guide to Getting Lost. I'm going to read it as well. I know you can probably all read it, but I want to hear it out loud. Certainly for artists of all stripes, the unknown, the idea or the form or the tale that has not yet arrived is what must be found. It's the job of artists to open doors and invite in prophecies, the unknown, the unfamiliar. It's where their work comes from. Scientists too, as Oppenheimer once remarked, live always at the edge of mystery, the boundary of the unknown. But scientists transform the unknown into the known, haul it in like fishermen. Artists get you out into that dark sea. I like Rebecca. I'm not sure if you've come across her work before. I highly recommend. She's an artist and an activist. She's a woman of my generation, and she's made her own definitions of what practice with others can be. I really respond to her proposition that as artists, we are used to getting people out into that dark sea of new possibility, that edge of mystery. Tim and I have always worked expansively across disciplines. I think music and sound are good at that, as they're spatial, relational, inclusive, vibrational, human and non-human all at the same time. And the forms in which our works take arise from these processes of research, invitation and trust. Over the last decade or so, our work has become increasingly concerned with the future of the planet. I imagine this is similar for all gathered here. Risk is a central part of the creative process and the scientific process. This lived experience in risk-taking led us into these ideas around existential risk. There's a particular categorization of existential risk which uses a sound metaphor to consider the ways that the world will end. Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher working at the Centre for the Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge, proposes four ways to categorize ways that the world might end, which builds on T.S. Eliot. They're called bang, crunch, shriek and whimper. So we started to think about existential risks as sound and how we might make hopeful protopian proposals about our shared futures rather than non-inclusive utopian or dark dystopian proposals. So this thinking has led us to a series of collectively made and experienced public listening works, some of which I'm going to share here now. These are projects that have been made with large numbers of collaborators in science, in ecology, tech, and art. We also think of the audience as collaborators. Here we go. This is Five Short Blasts. Five Short Blasts was originally commissioned by the City of Melbourne, and this work, Five Short Blasts, is an encounter with a city on the water. It's a work for an audience on a flotilla of boats and radio broadcast, created with the people and contingencies of the local site. In international maritime language, the sound signal of Five Short Blasts means, I'm not sure of your intentions and am concerned we are going to collide. And if you speak to any boaties and you say that the name of the show is Five Short Blasts, they all laugh because Five Short Blasts on a boat means, what the are you doing? I've got no idea what you're going to do. Glasses back on. Five Short Blasts is inspired and deeply informed by this maritime expression of uncertainty, drawing attention to the shared act of navigating the unknown. It's a work that changes with successive performances and sites, but it always changes because it takes place on and is about our relationship to the water. The vessel of a boat is a great place for listening. Five Short Blasts is, of course, a metaphor for the ever-changing waters of culture and place, the vessel of the boat being a potent image, a vessel for those who seek refuge. Five Short Blasts takes that metaphor and literally casts the audience adrift onto a waterway that teems with conflicting and overlapping activities. The water's always been at the edge of the unknown, over the horizon, carrying the uncertainties of weather and the uncertainties of a hoped-for peaceful future. To undertake even the smallest water voyage presents a necessary and ever-present challenge to rational planning. What do I need? How do I get there? Who's with me? Where am I? Will we make it? We've presented Five Short Blasts in many different places in the world, including Hamburg, Prague, Brighton in the UK, Perth and Melbourne. Witness Stand. Witness Stand was commissioned by Perth Festival in 2021. It began in our imaginations with a persistent image of an audience sitting stranded by the tide. Witness Stand is an unlikely place to listen, sitting lightly on the land where it's built, on bespoke seating tiers with a custom-designed battery-powered sound system. An audience sit with and listen to the sight and to the sounds that are made by local, national and international artists that speak to each sight. The sound and music are framed and held by people whose sight it is, sitting within and alongside the sides of that place. The sights sit at a place of contestation of energies and are chosen in collaboration with the local community. The stands are sculptural and ephemeral. They become a spine throughout a region. Over a period of time, audiences can visit all these sites. This first iteration of Witness Stand was commissioned and presented by Perth Festival in 2021, and it was made in collaboration with lead Noongar artists Barry Maguire and Kylie Bracknell and 10 local music sound artists. We remained in Melbourne for the duration of the project because that was during the pandemic closures. We worked out new ways of remote collaboration for sound and sight-based work. So through a series of these remote site visits, seven places were identified by Barry along the river and out to Wajumup, which is Rottnest Island. Stands were installed at these key sites, which hold stories that both Indigenous people and settlers need to hear together. We created hour-long works at each site, integrating Barry's insights, the local sound artists' responses, and our intersections. The second and third iterations of Witness Stand were presented at Homo Novus Festival in Latvia in September 21 and Brighton Festival UK in May 22, with sites that consider currencies of protest and identity. Witness Stand brings people together who may not usually come together. It's an idea and a methodology. Sound is a vibration and oscillation and results from attention. With Witness Stand, we sit together literally and metaphorically at nodal points of cultural vibration. X-Risk. Over 2017 to 2019, so pre-pandemic, we spent some time working ourselves and later with colleagues in Finland, UK and Ireland on an artistic exploration of existential risk I mentioned earlier. This image shows myself and a Finnish colleague on the melting ice of the Bothnian Gulf, whose winter ice freezes more thinly with each year. Together we undertook an existential risk bus ride, visiting sites to consider aliens, nuclear catastrophe, pandemic and other existential risk phenomena in the UK in February 2019. And then we presented a work entitled X-Risk in Kuopio, Finland, which involved a walk through a cemetery, some drones and a theatre presentation that explored warming, nuclear danger and pandemic as existential risks in December 2019, just before the pandemic hit. Oh, I know. This one, Deluge, it's a new work. Commissioned by the Science Gallery in Melbourne in 2022 with Arts House Melbourne. It's a temporary sound installation of moving ultrasonic speakers that allow the physical environment to speak. It's composed using a set of specially commissioned moving ultrasonic speaker sculptures. The multi-channel sound platform is a new instrument for an open-ended exploration of directional sound in architectural space. We hope that this new instrument does for sound what projection mapping does for light. We're driven to engage with this question, how do we live with ourselves, which speaks to critical global emergencies and hybrid and carbon negative ways of working. Deluge asks, what are the impacts of our actions on the ecologies we inhabit? What are our responsibilities? How do we act ethically within the complex intersections of our technologies, bodies and environments? In addition, with Deluge, we explore the aesthetic and ethical implications of artificial speech by creating our own artificial voices, just using Resemble AI, and the associated torrents of utterance with their algorithmically concentrating swarms of misinformation, asking us about the impacts of our actions, non-actions. Hyperdirectional sound, like a sound spotlight, allows for the perception of a sound texture within extremely localized regions, creating the illusion that the sound is somehow coming from an imaginary speaker. The effect is an extremely agile directionality and location of the audio. I won't say any more about that. Whip on. Here we go. Pivot. Right, pivot is a field of semi-intelligent seesaws that talk and sing and are activated by the audience of riders. The riders speak to each other and to the seesaw. Their voices are amplified. The seesaw voice is varied across the field, and the seesaw is definitely an unreliable poetic narrator. Pivot was commissioned through a series of relationships. In 2018, Simon Abrahams at Melbourne Fringe and Jennifer Barry at Federation Square and their teams. Simon asked us to come up with an idea for a work. The theme of his festival was democracy. He gave us some seed funding to buy us time to think and said to let him know what we wanted to do and he would make it happen. He's the dream commissioner. We had a 2-year lead time. The seesaw emerged for us as a workable physical tool that could encapsulate the democratic thematic because it's always and obviously an apparatus for negotiation. It doesn't work as a device unless you've reached a kind of physical agreement with the person on the other end. This physical dialogue, a less competitive scenario than, say, a game of tennis, then gave us a frame to incorporate another universal two-way negotiation, which is, of course, the dialogue. Combining these two things gave us a chance to think about music and composition. The seesaw gives a certain rhythm of speech, counterpointed through physical motion, expanded through multiple seesaws into an orchestrated field of negotiating pairs. We like to make works that work with us and as a physical experience. And this physical experience for two with Pivot becomes a spectacle for others. So far, so good. Yet, a seesaw can just be a seesaw without anybody reflecting on its nature as an implied metaphor for democratic process or anything else. And how would people be invited to talk? Our solution was to have the seesaw acting in character do the invitation. Okay, I'm just going to show a video from this first iteration in Melbourne and talk over it. And if it's okay, if we can have the audio off on the video, thank you. The emergence of the artificial voice is allowing artists such as ourselves to work with sound ecologies in new ways. In a way, it could be thought of as a part of a continuous lineage that begins with the ability to make song, say 200,000 years ago, and continues into different ages of mechanical reproduction, tape loops and re-splices and digital sound. It expands or enables in a new way compositional frameworks for working with sound and for working with vocal sound. Similar to the way that Barbara Kruger or Jenny Holzer have utilised graphic text in a new way, we engage with the cheapened reduction that is the corporate or monetised version of artificial speech, manifest in the design of user products, APIs, etc., to broaden or introduce a new artistic palette in the space of working with human, non-human orality. Some of the limitations and glitches and inevitable inadequacies are fertile parameters for our artistic focus. We embrace the jank. They can reinforce a kind of reinsurance that AI is not and perhaps should never be everything that some people make it out to be. We call our seesaw implementation of the conversational bot semi-intelligent, a poetic descriptor as a reflection of deterministic and limited algorithmic computations on human expression. Poetic because making the piece is a piece of creative scripting. We aren't concerned for accuracy or narrative sense. The translations between languages, between voice and text, between live and recorded are zones of speculation, literacy, and responsibility. We work closely with the Society of Visually Impaired Sound Artists, which is called SOVISA, and I highly recommend you check them out, founded by Andy Slater in Chicago with Australian co-conspirator Fayyan Devi, to create works that embed and expand the possibilities of audio description. It's clear that futures are made that reflect the groups that make it. I guess I've said that a few times already. We research the current stage of conversational agents. These are generally designed in the realm of the virtual assistant, which is a problematically commercial and identity-profiled servant of the consumer economy. A female art voice asks you what you want and need. In surveying the state of the conversational agent field, we discovered these agents are templates for scripting possible dialogues with different slots that, instead of zeroing in on what particular product the consumer wanted, could instead partake in an absurdist poetic journey. That could range from the monosyllabic through to quotes from appropriate or inappropriate poets or the odd information bomb. The agent machine as pattern matching is a tool for live verbal composition. It might make sense or not, but it gets people talking. Especially the emerging generation of AI embraces mostly aged under 12. How am I going time-wise?
I think you probably need to start wrapping
up. Cool. Part of our research, we met with the team at RMIT who worked on the development of Siri and with the Google Creative Lab team. RMIT team told us it was impossible to create an agent that could conduct a machine dialogue in a noisy possible public space. The many difficulties included an insurmountable noise floor, as well as the gnarly problem in agent design of the machine understanding when someone had begun speaking without us. Luckily for us, art doesn't require accuracy, customer satisfaction, or increased sales. Okay. Going to wrap up. Here we are, looking happy. So many things to keep saying. I want to finish on this. At the moment, these are some of the limitations. There's so many limitations in what we're doing still. So at the moment, each of the pivot characters have a voice that's identified as female. This is in direct response to the Siri assistant model of a female assistant who will assist you. However, we created a character that's female sounding, that is rambunctious, angry, hilarious, poetic, thoughtful, unreliable, and expert. That's the sort of character that we want to be heard. It's sort of a resistance. Ideally, we would like to work with a voice that's non-binary, but we're currently limited by the speed of the internet with our voice-to-text translation. There are many edges of the work that we're keen to develop and many new pathways to meander along. Thank you for listening. As Pivot might say when you jump on, hello, are you human? Welcome to art.
Thank you, Madeline. So, look, we'll do applause at the end when we thank both artists together. But I'm just aware that there is another event coming in after us, so we need to keep moving. So we'll move over to Adam, just a quick few questions to commence. I know you studied visual art but found your way into sound art and then eventually into the broader field of art and technology. So can you tell us a little bit about that journey? So how did you end up now starting as a visual artist and now you're working with cybernetics?
Yeah, so actually I went to QCA to study fine art and wanted to be a painter, and end of first year, I did sculpture, and I found it was a lot more freeing, so started thinking about other mediums. And it was actually Wendy Mills, she asked me a question, because I used to play a lot with optics and lenses, and I found them very beautiful. And she asked me, what are you interested in? Is this because they're beautiful, or is it about physics and things? And you know, I grew up with an appreciation of science and machines, and I started to think about physics and whether you could focus other things like sound. And this got me interested in alternative mediums. And I think through this, through talking to physics professors, just out of a pure need to try and figure out how you might focus sound or create different experiences, it led to an obsession that is heavily reliant on technology, and it's that's how I got into eventually working with robotics. That's a short answer.
I mean, it's interesting because I don't believe you two have met until
no,
now.
No. And, so nice to meet.
I have met them both, and I think it's interesting. There is an interesting overlap, isn't there? You've got to say that. And so what excites you about bringing art and technology together, say, compared to being a painter? You've already kind of semi-answered that, I suppose. But also, what excites you about bringing art into the public spaces outside of the gallery? So you've gone away from the traditional model of being an artist, I guess, but moved into a different field.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's still the same thing that every artist wants. They want to create dialogue and sense some sort of experience and impact on people, and that having these, yeah, this idea of otherworldliness, or
and bringing that alive.
Yeah.
And
it's not an easy answer.
Otherworldliness is a great phrase, yeah.
I know that you know, let's contrast, for example, in answering that question. Adam and Katrin have just had this amazing, successful exhibition at ZKM, and ZKM is like the, you know, the acknowledged world leader in a museum of electronic art, and they've collected Adam and Katrin's work as well. So they had... Empathy Swarm, wasn't it, on site for what, couple, you know...
10 months?
10 months in an exhibition.
10 months.
So how would you contrast this with that? You know, I mean, the amount of audience that's happening here is quite extraordinary, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
In comparison. I mean, one of the artists last year said, he was a sound artist, and he said he had 2,000... people through his work a day, and a lot of people stopped and talked to him about what was happening in his artwork, which he was thrilled about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of engagement with the public that artists so love, really. And
right, yeah, I mean, it's we've done we call it a performative installation because we're there also acting to let's say, we'll say keep the narrative of what's happening,
yeah.
And which keeps people in the moment, and it's that it's really different, right, than doing it in a theatre or a gallery. You have people who would generally never go in, and sometimes there's the people that are affected the most. They're just, what is this? Amazing. And spatially, acoustically, because for the work, being outdoors is really different and perfect. Normally, when we work indoors, I'll describe it later when we're talking about some of how we generate the music.
I know you and Katrin are very interested in emotion and empathy, and you've talked a little bit about that. What role do your robots play with this topic or goal in mind? And how does your work fit into the field of research of machine learning and replicating emotion? I mean, is it very basic where you are now, and do you intend to?
No, I would say that we're in this field where there's not so much so much research focused on the ethics and empathy of how robots deal with this concept. It's actually a huge missing cognitive gap. So there's no fundamental groundwork.
Right. Okay.
Not a lot, anyway. So in this particular work, we're using detecting the body and the skeleton, and we will use that in a way to build our own sectioned-off database, if you like, so machine learning, that can help us understand how people are moving and what aspect of their movement is to do with how they're feeling. So previously, we've been using emotion recognition, like faces, say sad and things, happy, sad, angry, for our last work, Empathy Swarm. But this is really problematic because as soon as people know that it's emotion recognition, they start to pull faces, yeah? And essentially, what we think is that they're teaching the robots how to deceive. So we've been working with dancers and looking at how dancers deal with the aspect of how to get emotion out for emotion and try to understand that. So it's a new experiment in that regard.
That's interesting, yeah. Let's just now move on to having a little bit of a run through of some of Adam and Katrin's previous works. And their current work, obviously, that's on show. So who has been down to play with the robots so far? Yes, okay, on the tour yesterday. Great.
Okay, so title, Psychophysics, Empathy and Embodiment of AI. So I want to talk a little bit first about where I'm coming from. Unable to map myself as a coherent self within the work's multiple coordinates, I am set adrift in uncertainty and I am discharged into the non-time of free-floating reminiscence. Gene Fisher. So this is a quote that I quite like, which sort of describes a practice I was involved with before I met Katrin, which was working on creating different sound sculptures, which are, on one hand, they're a musical instrument. On the other hand, they're a sculptural artifact. And on the other hand, they're also a psychologist, if you like. So this is a work that I toured in Europe for about 10 years, a few of the robots. It's called Psychophysics Machines, and psychophysics is an area of neuroscience that looks at how the brain is affected, for example, by spatial awareness. And it's used in all sorts of fields to do with hearing and autism. And but I created these works because I wanted to create sound experiences that are normally not possible, that you would play over a pair of speakers, for example. And we have one object in the middle. It's called Dr. Doppler. It spins about 500 revolutions per minute, and it's able to create 64 virtual loudspeakers through its motion, and it has lights on it as well. And the lights are in opposition sometimes to how the sound is moving, and it actually can make you dizzy and almost fall over. And the object on the right is called Curious Tortophone, and it is based on some psychological experiments to do with vowel sounds coming from the 40s, actually. I'm really interested in a lot of old, forgotten psychological experiments to do with sound. But you can think of it as a machine that is the acoustic version of the Rorschach test. And it's using a very special speaker on it, so it's called a parametric acoustic array. It uses ultrasound to create high pressure wave that is modulated on an acoustic signal, and it is essentially like a laser beam of sound. So this is a history that I've been working with these since 2001 when I did a residency with the Defence Science and Technology Organisation in Adelaide, where Australian Network for Art and Technology put me with the Underwater Operations Division because they work with ultrasound, and I had read some papers that it would be possible to do this, and they had the technology to do it. So together we figured out how to make some, and I've been making them ever since. This is one of the machines from Psychophysics Machines in Action. It's called Multiplexing Tortophone, and it's also able to spin very, very fast, and essentially it takes this very focused beam of sound and multiplexes it in the room, and so that you get many points of sound all around the room and becomes a hyper sound sculpture. I'll talk a little bit, I guess, also about how it's designed. These are manufactured by me. I have CNC equipment, and I built these in the studio using CAD software. And they're somehow meant to be something that looks like something NASA made or something that an engineer made rather than something an artist made. And this talks a little bit about machines making machines. And I think you were talking about being a country person. I grew up in far north Queensland in mining towns like Weipa and Mount Isa, and something that's really affected me my whole life is this mixture of machine and the landscape. And I used to dream of them, and now I think, do they dream of me? So this is a work called Circular Audiometry. Again, it's a type of acoustic psychological test slash art. And it has a special speaker at the bottom of as well, and it's infinitely producing spirals and movements in the space to trigger latent speech through voice. And there is a bunch of positive affirmations always coming out of this, kind of ASMR. And people are invited to this space sometimes to lay underneath it, and it's somehow unrecordable in Europe. Irreproducible because of the way the sound is generated. It never really repeats twice. Okay, so I'm gonna... No, it's fine. This is Katrin and I's first collaboration. This is Curious Tortophone Tensor Field Ontology. And Katrin and I met in Switzerland. 6 years ago now, she was working for MUDA, which is was a digital art museum in Zurich, and I was working at the ETH working on acoustic levitation. And
acoustic levitation.
Acoustic levitation. That's another story. I don't have any of that here. I'm sorry, but we figured out very early on that we could actually really mix what we're doing. She is a programmer. She studied architecture and was into parametric design and also digital fabrication. So at the ETH there, they have huge robots that build buildings and architecture. I think it's one of the world leaders. It looks so futuristic, like Gattaca. I think it looks amazing there. But this is one of her magnetic field lines projections on Curious Tortophone, one of the robots I'd previously built. And
is there a relationship? I mean, I can see it's mapped onto it, but is it responding?
Well, magnetic field lines are invisible, so it's this invisibility, this intangibility of the sound and the magnetic field lines. And the point at which you see these points on the ground is sort of visualizing where the sound goes as well. But it's very mesmerizing if you sit there. Some people sit there for an hour just absorbing how the sound is reflecting around the room. So that's a quick intro to our first collaboration, and then we started to work on Empathy Swarm, which was born from when we first fell in love. We said, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we created a bunch of robots that could also share with other people's empathy and love and envelop them around. And then we started this five-year journey of making various different iterations, first one, then another prototype, then another prototype, then 10, then eventually got to 50. And then we did another 50. And as you see here, they're forming different societies, different groupings, different continents, evolving over time. And it's using an algorithm. You could say it's using artificial intelligence, but it's not ChatGPT, artificial intelligence. It's something much more simple. And this is the work that ZKM collected. So it's not on show at the moment, but they do promise that they'll put it back on at some point.
Can you tell us about the music that's playing with it? Is that?
That's just something that I played, composed.
Yeah.
Just for the video.
Oh, yeah. So in the room with them, is it silent? In the room with them, is it silent?
In this version, it's silent. Yeah. There's all wheeled robotics, but the wheels and everything are designed with technology that's completely silent. So they make a little pitter patter as they move around. We are working on a next version with that of 50 with parametric speakers on them as well. So
cool.
I'm just flying through. So a little bit what we're interested in doing on a more, when we, Catherine and I try and figure out what we can do and how we can get it to work, and especially empathy. Understanding empathy, we have cognitive empathy, actively putting yourself into someone else's shoes, like being able to understand what other people are feeling. And then affective empathy, which is automatic and contagious, like, you know, when you hear of someone close dying, you know, or a friend having troubles and the feelings you might get, this is, you know, this automatic empathy. And then social empathy, deep contextual understanding. And the last thing, a lack of effective empathy of humans is called a sociopath. So I'll get into that in a minute as well, slightly. And yeah, so we, this is Sophia. Everyone may know Sophia. She's quite a famous talking robot that uses artificial intelligence to generate responses. And I talked a little bit before about, let's say, the research into how robotics responds to empathy and their role in society. And it seems like there's a lot of research into anthropomorphic robots, humanoid robots, but there's not really a lot of background into how we got there. So we were more interested to come and focus on really asking some fundamental building blocks questions, and which is why we came up with these very simple hexagonal robots, because they're non-anthropomorphic. They decidedly not non-humanistic. They also have a three legs or three wheels, which is not something you find in nature. But using this algorithm, which is from Craig Reynolds, who made Boyds in 1986. I don't know if anyone knows that. It's like a computer simulation of fish swimming or birds flying. And it uses this very simple algorithm of alignment, cohesion, separation, wandering, searching, and avoidance to create the apparent behavior, you could call it. So, you know, it's not real fish, it's not real birds flying around, but it looks like it is, and everyone who watches it would agree that it looks like it is. This is called emergence. And so we play with this with Empathy Swarm by doing camera tracking. So we make people into blobs. The camera tracking is also seeing the robots as a type of blob. And there is a what we call a hive mind, so which communicates this information to the robots. And sometimes they want to come close to you, and sometimes they want to move away from you. And depending on how fast you're moving, and this is to do with emotion again as well. And we deal with this concept of intimate space and how close we are to things to generate these compassionate responses. And how do we know that can work? Well, these are some of the things that we think about through motion. So maybe we don't have time to really get into it, but I will skip, actually. Functioning is not merely the function of things, but also their mystery. And how do we know that we could do this robotics? Well, this is a little video from an experimental study of apparent behavior, which is done by Fritz Heider and Marianne Simmel in 1944. And as you can see, it's just two triangles, a sphere, and some rectangles. And this is a study that they did. They showed this very simple 2D animation, and then they asked people what they thought was happening. And most people respond the same way. It's like two kids hanging out, and there's the angry neighbor, and they get into a conflict, and it gets a bit scary. And what they showed through this study was that humans are, for the most part, hardwired for compassion. Because it is, it's just, there's just black and white triangles and spheres. But it's our brain projecting all of this stuff. And then on a very rare occasion, they would have the response, they're just triangles moving around. And, you know, okay. They don't,
sociopath.
Right, they don't have this compassionate response. So we knew that we could take this concept of Boyd's and use the relationships of interest and personal space and create this apparent behavior with people. And they would associate life to the motion and movement of the robots. And then what we've tried to do is we tried to close that loop through biofeedback somehow so that the machines can eventually understand what's going on, recall those and start to develop through using machine learning more and more empathetic responses to do. Eventually the concept was to do storytelling in a sense, like perhaps do the hero's journey. And but it's still ongoing. I don't think we ever really solve that, but it's interesting to try.
Well, Adam, I think we need to wrap up, if that's okay with you. You have a special guest for us, though.
Right. We were talking so much about the sound. That I will do a little demonstration of how the sound works.
Great.
And it's happy on the carpet, of course, by the looks of it. Doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, it won't be walking because it needs its other brothers and sisters to...
To interact with, yes. Yep. Okay.
See if it's going to turn on this time.
Yeah, that old problem.
I don't think it's loading.
Okay. Well.
But anyway, I can put on some noise and you'll just... Oh, no, here we go.
Oh, yes. Here?
And should it also be able to point it off the off the wall?
Straight at me then. Oh, you got into my.
You can point it off the floor. And if you want to know more about how it works, come down and see the work, and you'll get to experience the hypersound sculpture of all of the robots together.
Thanks. So everyone, please join me in thanking both Adam and Madeline for joining us today. And sharing that very interesting background to their work. I learned a few new things about both. Look, we are short of time, but please, if you have any questions, we've got time for a couple of questions. Any questions? The mic. Oh.
Well, okay. Just how does it work, the directional sound from that machine?
Yeah, so it uses a few physics principles. The first is the concept of the parametric effect, which is, you would have noticed this if you've ever been to a rock concert and you've seen the big, they're called line arrays, the slightly curved stack of speakers like this. And it's the principle that if you have a certain wavelength, say the wavelength is this long of sound, if you have a device that is three or four times bigger than that, you start to, sound radiates normally out circular. And when you get to three or four times the wavelength, you start to create more of a focusing effect. So to create a focused speaker with normal sound, you would need the sound of a skyscraper, like the size of a skyscraper, to have this directionality that we have. And the second effect that we use is a nonlinear effect, and I will describe it that it happens when you oversaturate the air with a certain amplitude, a certain high pressure level. And if you play, it's always describing it quickly is always a thing. So what we're doing here is we're using ultrasound. It's 40 kilohertz. It's only very small wavelengths, eight millimeters more or less. And these are all ultrasonic transmitters. And because it's many, many, many times the size of the wavelength, it's only about 3 or 4 degrees, the ultrasound. And essentially what we do is we make a very highly pressurized disc of air. So we compress the air in front using the ultrasound at this high pressure level and becomes non-linear and flat. And before it can relax again, we slam it again. Mm. And you can imagine that there is really a disc of air that is becoming this virtual loudspeaker. And if you modulate that in the acoustic sound, you hear the sound in the ultrasonic column. And it doesn't reflect off anything, so it just sounds like it's coming from this ultrasonic column.
So it's kind of just shimmering in space, you know, as it moves around.
You can feel the vibrations. We also use it to do acoustic levitation, so you can put a little ant and make it float in space.
Wow.
Yeah. The ant's fine. The ant's fine.
Not too loud for the ant.
If you did it with humans, you'd need enough acoustic energy. You'd get a bit toasty. That's for sure. I wouldn't want to try it.
Okay, and one more question. Is anyone interested in one more question?
Well, now I want to know the biggest thing that you levitated.
it's ultrasound, so it's usually half the wavelength, so only 4 millimeters. So, yeah.
Small.
It's small.
Sparks. Is what
small
you're
polystyrene balls, bugs, and small rocks. Yeah.
Small rocks.
Rocks is nice. Yeah.
But that's an interesting artwork. I'm sort of starting to conjure some images that goes with that. That'd be good. Good looking, yeah. Okay, well, look, let's leave it there. I know that there's other people coming in here right now. So thank you for coming along. Please do see the other artworks. As I said, they're all down South Bank. You've got a week to do that. So it's all free. All the conversations are free. So enjoy. Thanks for coming, everyone. Bye now.
The World Science Festival is presented by the Queensland Museum Network. We are proud to partner with the Queensland Government, Tourism Events Queensland, Brisbane Economic Development Agency, the University of Queensland, Griffith University, QUT, and others who recognise the value of science.